The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Howdy do, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his court jester, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 54 of The Big Picture for the week beginning April 10. And coming up on today's show, it's our April Fool's Edition. Or is it? Okay, with lots of tomfoolery ahead.
But seriously, are you a fan of Fahrenheit 9/11 or Bowling for Columbine? Because Maverick doco maker Michael Moore is back to tell us where to invade next.
And we take a look at the final episode in the Divergent series, finally, with Allegiant hitting the big screen. Plus, I share with you my top five movie twists of all time.
Mate, I really stumbled through that intro to the show. Maybe that was an April Fool's practical joke on my part.
Or was it? And this is it. Yes, look, it is, in fact, our April Fool's Day edition. And yes, you may say it is way past April 1st, but hey, we can't be expected to be constantly imagining new things just because you and the rest of the world have got hung up on calendars. It's a tough job over here, okay? So let's just go with it and we'll see if it's funny.
Speaking of calendars and looking to what's around this week, The Huntsman Winter's War, Mark, is at cinemas. It started on Thursday. It stars Thor, or Chris Hemsworth, and a bunch of other chicks, Charlize Theron, Emily Blunt, Jessica Chastain, and it's kind of a prequel and a sequel to that Snow White and the Huntsman movie that was out a few years ago. We're going to review it on the show next week. I'll save my review for then.
And in other disappointing news, the second season of the Nine Network's Married at First Sight has kicked off 7:30 p.m. on Mondays and Tuesdays this week, and it seems to have backfired already in the family-friendly slot of 7:30 p.m. because 770,000 viewers tuned in. Sounds good. First season got 1.2 million to start. I don't think Australia's very happy.
Here's five words. Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Oh, okay.
It's out on Blu-ray, DVD, everything else. It's going to take over the universe. Go and get it if you haven't already.
I'll be back in 20 minutes. Okay, and April Fool's time. Well, actually, before we get to April Fool's, another interesting start this week, this time on SBS, Adam Ruins Everything. I love this idea as a program.
That's a great title for a show.
I know. Look,
glad it wasn't Ben Ruins Everything.
Adam Conover employs a combination of comedy, history, and science to dispel widespread misconceptions about everything we take for granted. Kind of think of Mythbusters, but funny. But gets rid of the sort of things that we thought were actually real, like the usefulness of credit card signatures, or lie detectors, or tamper-resistant seals apparently can be tampered with.
Okay. Well, who knew?
If you want to have your misconceptions dispelled, tune into SBS 2 Thursdays at 8 p.m.
Now, as part of our extended April Fool's Day coverage here on The Big Picture, and what we normally do around this time in the show is we have a true or false segment. But because of April Fool's Day being all around truth and falsity and that sort of thing, we thought let's have a special edition of true or false. So instead of one of us bringing a true or false fact, both of us are going to do that. And basically what I'm about to do in the next minute or so is reveal how big an idiot I was on April Fool's the most recently. So just over a week ago, I was trawling through Facebook and I happened to notice this post. So this is what a guy, another film reviewer, posted. He said, "As one of only a handful of defenders of Baz Luhrmann's Australia, I'm thrilled to hear of sequel news.
Oh.
If Baz brings all his usual flair to New Zealand and the local cast, Sam Neill, Keisha Castle-Hughes, if they deliver the goods, it will be the romantic sheep-shearing epic we didn't know we wanted. Well played, 20th Century Fox." Now, you're laughing away and presuming that that's well false. What I did is I scanned that and I stopped at about the part of where it said sequel news, and I thought, that sounds great because I actually liked Australia. So I ticked a like on that Facebook.
You were in that handful as well.
I didn't even just tick like on that Facebook post. I wrote something afterwards saying, oh, that'd be great because I really quite liked Australia. Until somebody pointed out in a reply about 2 minutes later, good one, April Fool's Day, chump.
Yeah. And yeah, when you fill that post in on April 3rd, it's never as funny. Speaking of April Fools, some people might have got it taken in by Google's April Fools joke, which lasted all of a couple of hours. See, minions are once again ruling our lives, or ruining them if you like, but this time they're partnered with one of the most powerful companies in the world, Google basically replaced the send button on Google Mail with a little GIF button. When you clicked it, it would add a minion GIF dancing and then
like a little animated minion.
Yeah, a little minion GIF dancing and then dropping the mic, and it would prevent people from seeing any replies to those emails. Okay, so this is the idea that you would send it, consider you working for your local funeral parlor. We're terribly sorry about the passing of your mother on this date. Boom! This is the minion, and that's pretty much it. Apparently, several people complained after they lost their jobs, associated with using this particular thing, and Google had it off in a couple of hours. So,
well,
we're truly sorry for everybody inconvenienced.
I still feel foolish about New Zealand. Let's move on to what your kids are watching this week, Mark. One of Disney's most beloved children's tales was first released as a musical animation in 1967. It starred a voracious tiger, a dancing bear, and a boy raised by wolves. We're, of course, talking about The Jungle Book. Rudyard Kipling's collection of stories about boy Mowgli and the jungle powers that raise him is no stranger to cinema. It's actually its first trip to the big screen, took place in 1942, and since then, it's had 5 reincarnations. The latest version released at cinemas this week, and it leaves us wondering whether God made a mistake elevating man above the wisdom of animals.
This is not a game. The jungle is no longer safe for you. You're being hunted by a tiger. Down.
Have I got your attention now? How many lives is a man cub worth?
Trust in me.
Seize him.
This is my home.
All right, Mark, how did this go as a film? What did it look like particularly? I've seen the trailers for this. It looks like a visual masterpiece.
It is, in fact, something that people are going to be thrilled to just see, especially when they know that this is a brilliant feat in CGI. There is no actual jungle in this film.
I'm not going then.
No, seriously. Because if only to see, you won't be able to see, I spent 2 hours to get the plot. I spent 2 hours staring at the screen just going, how is that not a jungle?
But everything is computer generated. And the animals, jungle, all that. And
everything.
But the boy is real.
The boy is real? Okay. Yep. What is his name? I've got it here somewhere.
So the young actor who plays Mowgli, he's the only real thing about The Jungle Book.
Yeah, that's true. And basically, the entire plot is done in a soundstage, against chroma key. It's incredibly engaging. Great animal effects, but no live animals.
Oh.
Makes it nice and safe. Probably good for insurance.
Now, you being the guy on the show who actually reads books, you did read the original collection of stories that Rudyard Kipling wrote that The Jungle Book's based on.
True.
So does it differ much, this new version directed by Jon Favreau, who brought us Iron Man and other big films I can't think of off the top of my head right now? How does it differ much?
There are a couple of key differences I think people need to be aware of. Look, the first to note is that Rudyard's story was in fact actually a collection of short stories, and Mowgli was in some of them. Okay, so it's kind of like, Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book is like Aesop's Fables. Okay, it was basically a series, or maybe like you might have heard of Dr. Paul White, the Jungle Doctor, that Christian sort of writer. Don't look at me so blankly.
No, I haven't, but I just did.
Our listeners have. Anyway, so that's how the stories are sort of arranged.
Yeah.
It's a series of, and this is one great big story. The second thing is that Kipling's stories about Mowgli have a lot to do with his connection with the human world. This film includes some connection with the human world, there's the humans, and Mowgli's really got to go back to them. But that's pretty much it. It's just like a motivation for the rest of the plot that's going on.
Okay, and basically, what is the plot of Jungle Book?
The plot of this story, it's the basic line of The Jungle Book, that Shere Khan the tiger has decided that Mowgli has no place in the jungle, and even though Bagheera the panther and Baloo the bear, are supporting Mowgli, and that Mowgli belongs to the wolf tribe. That's it. There's no place for humans in the jungle, so I'm going to eat you. And it's a fairly straightforward sort of law of the jungle, so to speak.
How scary is this for kids?
Well, it's not as scary as you would think. I think it's been really well managed by Disney. It's not going to terrify. Shere Khan's the villain, but the tiger has good reason to be villainous to them. Here's one of the major changes. He's been burnt by humans in the past, okay? And literally naturally burns. It's not like he had a bad relationship. He's been set on fire. Okay. And this is what's happened. So in essence, in the original books, Shere Khan was just a homicidal maniac, you know, who just wants to eat everything and kill for the fun of it. In this, he's got a bit of justification going on, killing those nasty humans. And the biggest change of all in this is that Mowgli, in the original Rudyard Kipling stories, leaves the jungle, okay? Because he realizes in the end that human beings occupy a different position in creation, okay? And so he can't live as an animal.
Right, so without giving too much away about this version of Jungle Book, but it's sounding to me like this Mowgli is more in tune with nature around him. Is that a good or a bad thing, you reckon?
Well, it's not a problem, okay, to be in tune with nature. I mean, God created human beings as part of the created order.
Yeah, so it's a positive message coming from the Jungle Book.
Yeah, but listen carefully to the phrase created order. I mean, that's what God had. Not a level playing field where all animals are the same, including human beings, but an order to things. You know, God was in charge. He sets man over creation as the peak of his creation in order to steward it and take care of it, to preserve it to his glory, okay? And Kipling, look, we're not really sure how Christian Kipling was. He was an amazing Freemason, we know that much, you know, but we don't really know about his Christian commitment. But he was very much a product of the Victorian era, where in which he thought that humanity had a role to play on the world, and it was one that was above that of the animals. So in the end, Mowgli has to be separate from the animals, whereas this story is all about Mowgli being the same as the animals and tucking up with the wolves in the end and finding his place as one of them.
So more a product of our times.
Yeah, and to be honest, so parents should be a little bit aware of this, that we are not all the same. This is actually something that suggests that human beings and animals are pretty much of equal standing.
The Jungle Book is rated PG for mild threats and violence and some scenes that may scare younger children. I actually heard that a reviewer we often feature on our show, Russ Matthews, jumped out of his seat twice during this film. I kid you not.
Is terrified of snakes. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
It's directed by Jon Favreau and stars the vocal talent of Ben Kingsley, Idris Elba, and Bill Murray, and many others. It opened last Thursday, so go check it out. You're still saying?
Oh, look, I think it's a great film.
Yeah.
Just be aware.
All right.
Okay. Coming up yet, we still have a fantastic piece to do with documentaries. If you're into documentaries, well, Michael Moore's back with Where to Invade Next. And hang around because you're going to see the third installment, finally, of the Divergent series.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Yes, and The Big Picture, Mark.
We've come to that part. At least we know where we are.
The Big Picture.
We've come to that part of the show where we talk about soundtrack. Basically, the music that sits behind the films and the presentations of the television shows that we're seeing. Now, we were talking about The Jungle Book. And so why not dig back into that classic 1967 version of The Jungle Book and possibly the best known song by Terry Gilkison, sung by Phil Harris as Baloo and Bruce Reitherman as Mowgli. It is The Bare Necessities.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities are Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be found off my big home. The bees are buzzing in the tree to make some honey just for me. When you look under the rocks and plants and take a glance at the fancy ants, then maybe try a few. The bare necessities of life will come to you. They'll come to you. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities. That's why a bear can rest at ease with just the bare necessities of life. Now when you pick a pawpaw or a prickly pear, and you prick a raw paw, well next time beware. Don't pick the prickly pear by the paw. When you pick a pear, try to use the claw. But you don't need to use the claw when you pick a pear of the big pawpaw. Have I given you a clue? The bare necessities of life will come to you. They'll come to you.
It's very hard for me not to actually want to dance around the room when I hear this. And the reason why is because as a child, this was the only record we had on a record player. I'm sure my parents actually had some stuff like Mandovani. I don't know, things that they were listening to.
Manda what now?
Get back there. Back in the Dark Ages. Yeah, so like every Saturday basically meant putting on the Jungle Book. This is pre-TV, people. You know, it's just dancing around the lounge room to this. It was a simple time. Look, one of the interesting things about this Terry Gilkison song is that he actually wrote, you know, about a half dozen songs for the Jungle Book, all of which Walt Disney rejected because they were too close to the original book and too close to the idea of the seriousness or the darker shades that are actually in Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. He said, basically, look, what we really need to do is look at all the nice, mysterious, heavy stuff and give it a light Disney touch. You know, so every time he actually brought in the Sherman Brothers, famous sort of composers that worked with Disney, and he said to them, every time you see something that's scary, write a funny song to fit into that bit. And that's basically what they did.
Make it funnier sooner.
And the only one that lasted from the original Terry Gilkison sort of soundtrack was The Bare Necessities.
And it's made its way all the way to this new version of The Jungle Book, hasn't it?
Bill Murray actually sings The Bare Necessities and does a great job of it. Well, we're up to the first Now Showing segment of our show. Almost single-handedly, Michael Moore turned documentaries from those sorts of real-life films that only people like me would want to watch to topical and provocative movies that filled millions of seats at the cinemas. The outspoken and explosive guy behind Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11 is back with Where to Invade Next. Again, Moore is crusading to make the USA a better place, but how realistic is it? The search for a perfect solution to huge social problems.
It's been 6 years since anyone's seen him. But when our nation needs help, America's secret weapon is the only one who can save us.
USA! Yeah!
My mission? I will invade countries with names I can mostly pronounce. Take the things we need from them and bring it all back home. Because we have problems no army could solve.
I'm going to tell you from my own personal life, abstinence works.
Michael Moore is back. and as he just described, what he's doing is going on something of what he describes as a military mission. There's a semi-humorous beginning to this documentary where he is enlisted by the American military. It's all a joke. But he goes off on this military mission to invade, quote unquote, all these other countries around the world. And as he says, he's there to pick the flowers, not the weeds. And so he goes to about 10 or 12 countries across the course of two hours, mainly in Europe. And he goes from everywhere from like France to Iceland, and actually goes to Tunisia as well, which I understand is not in Europe, but he goes to that part of the world and gets all these different ideas, largely around schooling, around medicine, health, and then also around kind of equal rights, equal standing for men and women in society. And the whole purpose of this exercise is basically so he can gather up all of these ideas and then bring them back to America, as it were, to make America a better place.
Kind of makes me feel like this would only be a documentary for American audiences. I mean, yeah. They're the only ones who are going to really be invested in this.
Yeah, I thought some of his other documentaries, like we've mentioned earlier in the program, the big ones that really kind of brought him to world attention, like Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, as much as they were about American issues, they seem more for a global audience, perhaps because they were tapping into some universal themes. And again, this one does, but the way he's tapping into it, Michael Moore, does seem to limit it more to American audiences. So sitting back in Australia and watching this, some of the ideas that show up in various countries, we already have. And so to have a guy telling us how great it is.
A healthcare system. We should get one of those.
That's right.
What?
And, you know, advocating that kids eat healthier lunches and that sort of thing. It's like, wow, who knew? it does seem to, Michael Moore loves to like hammer American stereotypes, but also he likes to kind of goof them up a little and hand them up on screen as well. He can get a little bit confused, I think, sometimes in his presentation of himself and his own country.
Yeah,
as
I was going to say, because Michael Moore, like one of the things about him is often the best and worst thing about his own documentaries. Like, he's got this amazing gall that he can sort of breeze into situations and do things, but then often it's all about him. Did that happen?
Yeah, yes, it does. I'm a little bit on the fence about Michael Moore, increasingly so, and definitely after Where to Invade Next. You're exactly right. He is the best and worst thing about his film. So where I'm sitting on the fence is, on the positive side, it's great that there's someone out crusading for things and trying to go up against stuff that they think isn't right. And a lot of the things he's objecting to in American society, fair enough. I can see why you would. On the negative side, as you just mentioned, he can get in the way of his own message often. You can often make me feel a bit more cynical than I want to be about what he's doing. I think he's got a way of presenting information that can too narrowly present it. So he will advocate for particular ideas out of these various countries. He goes to Italy and talks up the way they look after workers and the way that workers are treated and the amount of annual leave they get. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to be acknowledging anywhere that, as far as I understand, Italy's economy is in a pretty terrible place. I'm not an economics guy at all, but I watch the news enough to know that countries like Italy have some issues. And as much as Michael Moore does say, I'm here to pick the flowers, not the weeds, as he continues to pick the flowers and the way he presents the flowers...
He has to step over a lot of weeds.
And it can make it seem a little bit too pristine, a little bit too perfect in these other nations. One of the more interesting things, I think, that come out of this, and as an Australian viewer, let alone anywhere else in the world, one of the things he really picks up on is there's a great tension about how different countries approach their own history that kind of waves through. So many ideas come up in Where to Invade Next, but one of them, the positive ones, as a country like Australia that struggles to know what to do with its own history, particularly when it comes to Indigenous people, he makes an interesting point about the way Germany reflects upon its own history and how America has a really difficult time with that and effectively forgiving itself or even admitting its own faults in what it's done to Indian and Native American people across the course of time. So on the plus side, he does that kind of stuff, which raises some very interesting, pertinent questions for the rest of us in the rest of the world. But really, by and large, Where to Invade Next is a presentation for American people that presumably, or he's suggesting, are very silly, don't know much about the world and need to have these ideas rammed down their throat.
Well, speaking of the ideas that are raised, is the whole premise of the documentary the idea that you can create a utopia? That the idea is you should be able to somehow bring this all together and we will live in a better land?
He doesn't quite go that far, but I think that's what you walk away with from Where to Invade Next. I think one of the great things about any documentary that dares to go up against some of the prevailing either ideas or the situations in society is if it then goes further and tries to suggest solutions for that. And so Where to Invade Next, on the positive side, is trying to do that. It's trying to present solutions. One of the interesting things about it, one of the frustrating things, I think, I keep going back to that. Actually, I'm interested enough, but I'm very frustrated by this documentary, is that all these ideas, or many of the ideas that he comes up with or discovers or researches as he goes to other countries, he claims were originally American ideas. And so effectively, it sounds like America was once a utopic society or could have been a perfect society, and it forgot about these original ideas that it had. And then as a result, it's kind of gone a bit south and, you know, hasn't really brought it all together. Left me thinking about how often we can forget some of the bedrock ideas, the foundation ideas that we already have anyway. So we often talk about it on this program. We're Christians who understand the way God's put the world together and well, as much as we can. And we try to go back to earlier in the Jungle Book about order and the way God's put the world together. But let alone everything from the world order to how relationships work and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of original information provided to us through God's word about the way God's world exists. And I think often we can just forget that. And we want to go off on these other tangents and try these other things and think we've got better solutions to come up with. And so something I took out of Where to Invade Next, I don't think Michael Moore intended this, but it drove me back more towards God's word to think about, we have all these answers already about how to improve the world, how to improve society, how to make it a better place for all of us. We can just often forget about it or choose to ignore it. And what one of the things Where to Invade Next does raise is maybe we should go back to these original ideas and try to use them again. I'd be pointing people back towards the Bible. Michael Moore instead is pointing people to a tapestry of European countries.
Mate, sounds, well, interesting, but, you know, I don't know. I wonder if I've got to change my citizenship before I actually want to go watch it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Where to Invade Next stars Michael Moore and a lot of people who aren't American, though. It's rated M for coarse language, nudity, because of the documentary, and most suitable for Americans. So if you're not, well, gosh darn it, you're plumb out of luck.
The Big Picture is online. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and check out all the past editions of our show. What are we up to now? Episode 54?
54. Next week, we're doing 55.
So that means...
Last week... No, don't worry.
Okay. Yeah. So that means there are 53 back editions of The Big Picture, full of movie and TV reviews from a Christian perspective. Go and check them out, thebigpicturewebsite.com.
And of course, coming up yet, we've still got some fantastic stuff to do with the Divergent series. We're going to be reviewing the latest and final installment, hopefully the final installment of the Divergent series, Allegiant. But before we get there, we're actually going to talk to a dyed-in-the-wool fan, a 14-year-old girl who tells us how her Christianity actually is informed by what she watches on the films.
Welcome back to The Big Picture with Mark and Ben. The publishing universe has thrown up a range of dystopian futures for teenagers to consider, from the blasted world of The Maze Runner to the bleak society of The Hunger Games. One of the most popular in recent years has been author Veronica Roth's Divergent series. The three books were written by Roth, and they've sold millions of copies around the world and drummed up millions of dollars more at the cinemas, particularly where teenage girls are concerned. The third installment, as we've said a bunch of times today, in this Hollywood's version of Divergent is being released next week.
Next week.
Yeah, that's right, this Thursday. Before Mark brings us his thoughts on Allegiant, he's about to do that very soon, we thought it high time to ask one of those teenage fans why she thinks the Divergent series is so important to her generation. So for press record this week, that's exactly what Mark did.
Anna, thanks very much for being part of the show. Now, one of the reasons we're talking to you is because you are an acknowledged fan of the entire Divergent series. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Yes, I love it.
How much so? Have you read all the books, seen the films?
I have. I've seen both of the films and I've read all the books.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Triss, how do you refer to the heroine? Is it Triss or do you call her Beatrice or what do you call her?
Triss.
Triss.
Yeah.
What is it about Triss that makes her so attractive, particularly to young women?
I think she's quite sweet, but still a very strong sort of person. And she, although in the beginning she's quite shy, when she starts to grow into a woman, she becomes strong. And I think that teenage girls, when they think womanhood, they kind of think, oh, I want to be strong and independent, but still kind.
Now, you're a Christian.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, as you look at her, is that the sort of thing you're admiring the most, that you think you're going to need to take on as a woman of the future to be sort of strong in character? Is that what you're going to have to be?
Yeah, but with the help of God, not just by being influenced to be strong, but through God.
Now, that's the interesting thing. Where do you think Triss gets her strength?
Probably from her friends and her past, because she was taught to be selfless, but then she goes to her new faction where she's been taught to be brave. And through the film, they talk about how being selfless and brave are the same thing.
Is that how you see it, that selfless and brave are the same thing?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
Because I feel like to be selfless, you have to be brave. Because I feel sometimes when people are selfish, they're only doing things for themselves because they have cowardice and they're scared to almost stand up for other people and try and help people, but they just want to help themselves. So,
whereas to be truly brave,
yeah,
you've actually got to be prepared to sacrifice your own ambitions and things like that.
Yeah.
Is that how you see Christianity? Like a brave choice?
Yeah. And I think although you can be persecuted by people, but I think it's always good to know that although you'll be persecuted and people will not like you because you are a Christian, you'll always know that God will love you and that it doesn't matter what people think, because God, like in Jesus, will always love you.
Is that the only place you see your Christianity sort of being reflected in the whole Divergent series, or are there other things about the Divergent series that remind you of your faith?
I kind of think that the Divergents are like Christians.
Now, we'll just remind for people who are not completely across the Divergents, they have qualities of bravery, qualities of peacefulness, qualities of selflessness and intelligence. So they have to have all those things.
Yeah.
And I know plenty of Christians
And honesty, too.
And honesty. Yeah. And I know plenty of Christians have been accused of being cowardly, stupid, weak.
Well, I feel that it's in some religions, they focus on one thing. And I feel like Christianity focuses on a wide range of things and how to use your talents to help people. Because I think in Divergent, like the erudite, they help people through their knowledge, and Candor help people with honesty and justice, and Amity are kind and they help people in becoming like better people through kindness. And the Selfless, they help people, like the Factionless, when they're like there's starving people and they're being spit on by others, but they try and help them. And Dauntless, they're like the army and they're protectors and stuff. So
you can see all the qualities of Jesus in that. Sure. Without giving the plot away, what is the thing I think you'll take away from all three books or all three films?
To follow your beliefs and try and evangelize people or open people up to Christianity, like she does about the Divergence. Yeah, I think that's probably what I'll try to do,
Wow, Mark, you seem like you found the most eloquent 14-year-old around.
She's pretty spectacular, isn't she? Yeah. She really knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, she really does. So from someone who's in the target market who knows exactly what they're talking about with Divergent
to
you and your thoughts on this new film, Allegiant. So Divergent, as you were just discussing, is the first film to be made from the trilogy of teen novels by Veronica Roth. And it accounted for a cool, about $290 million worth of teenage pocket money back in 2014. Its follow-up, Insurgent, see what they're doing here? Divergent, Insurgent, collected $295 million, a little bit better, the next year, even though, as measured by Rotten Tomatoes, online, you know, where all the reviews get collated on this one website, Rotten Tomatoes, the film score halved with critics, as in pretty much critics just liked it half as much.
But even as the money was going up.
That's right. Who cares? Because the dollars did keep rising. Now, next Thursday, Allegiant, the third and final installment in the Divergent movie franchise, opens to the public. Mark saw a preview this week, and he discovered a world asking a key biblical question: why do humans struggle to do the right thing?
Welcome.
Your arrival is the most exciting event some of us have ever known.
Hey, four.
How do they know who we are?
Our surveillance technology is centuries ahead of anything you've known. They've grown up watching him.
Nothing creepy about that.
Tobias Eaton, you've been assigned to me.
It's a lot of firepower.
It'll take you a while to get the hang of it.
I think I got the hang of it. In 200 years, the greatest scientific minds have lived here to test a theory. If we could rescue people from a toxic environment and put them in a safe place like Chicago, perhaps they would heal it.
And I'm one of those people.
You're the only one.
Ah, Tris, the only one. Yet again, we have one of those sort of situations set up for teenagers where there is a beautiful guy or a beautiful girl who's the savior of the universe, if only they can find their way forward. Well, Tris, after having sort of survived two nasty sort of endeavors in first Divergent in the sort of futuristic dystopian Chicago, and then Insurgent when there's something of a rebellion going on in the same city, they finished that particular second film with the news that there were people outside, that the world wasn't a blast wasteland, and that they were in fact an experiment awaiting. They were now ready because the Divergent people had emerged to re-emerge from blasted Chicago and help the world with this new genetic form. Does this sound confusing to you?
It was just confusing. Look on my face. To me. Sound confusing?
Look, let's focus down on something really easy to follow.
Okay.
Tris and Four, the love couple, have decided to leave Chicago. There you go.
That's the plot of Allegiant?
That's pretty much it. They've decided to go out and find the outside world. And what do they find when they go outside? Well, they find the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. And out there is a lovely fellow called David who's in charge of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. And he is there to let them know that this is all part of a master plan. That, in fact, finally they've found a pure genetic code in Tris, the Divergent, who is, and this genetic code is, never explained actually, how he's going to do something for, we're not really sure who, to do something really fantastic that everyone should get excited about, but no one really knows why. Okay, so basically Tris is good, And David says, you know, you're the best. But then we start to get a few little elements in the plot that emerge. We discover that David thinks everybody who's not Triss is genetically damaged and they're not really valuable as human beings. It's really only the Divergent and, in fact, the pure Divergent. It turns out that Four is not as divergent as he thought. Apparently, he's only 95% divergent, and so, therefore, he's damaged.
So I haven't seen any of this Divergent series, and this, I'm a little bit confused about what's actually going on here, but to put a pin into this, does it even engage as a film, like particularly either for the target audience or for the parents that are going to get dragged along by their teenage daughters? Are they just going to be rolling their eyes at what's going on screen in Allegiant?
Parents, take a pillow, okay? Because I think it's about the most best advice I could give to going to the cinemas. I cannot believe there's this scene in the beginning, because there's sort of counter-revolution going on in Chicago, in which all these previous sort of dictators are being executed, okay? And I think one of them was the scriptwriter. Like, I think, seriously, ooh, they just, you know, the scriptwriter died in the first 5 minutes of the film, and that's why this film meanders all
over.
So
bring a pillow because you're going to go to sleep?
I feel that parents are going to be sitting there going, you know, I'm not really following this. It might be a good time. If they hadn't put up all those commercials about turning your mobile phone off in films, it'd be a good time to check Facebook.
What about for those that this film is targeted at?
Strangely, it's going to play the other way, okay? Because there are teens who are really thrilled by this franchise and follow it. And I feel like
it has been very successful, hasn't it? As much as we talked about at the start about reviews being terrible, and it sounds like yours is definitely that way. But you're right. Go back to the bit where it says the target audience is actually responding to this.
Now, this is one of the tricky things I think we have to remember. And ladies and gentlemen, we've got to admit this, that as reviewers, our opinion is not actually what counts the most. I'm a firm believer in looking at the box office returns, because when critics get all wrapped up about how bad something it is, but people are still spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy tickets, we've got to ask ourselves some heavy questions. What is it that actually appeals to these teens? In this case, I think it is basically elevating the idea of being passionate and decisive to the level of moral virtues, regardless of whether or not you're just, well, we would say as adults, probably just reacting to what you see and feeling emotional.
Are you saying that if you were Triss's dad, so just imagine you were Triss's dad in Allegiant, you'd be a little bit worried about Triss's behavior, young lady?
I'd be terrified. And this is the weird thing. So parents will look at the behavior and just go, oh, this is the very last thing I want to encourage in my teen. She's emotional. She's flying off the handle at things. She doesn't think things through. She takes things at face value, as if somehow somebody telling her you're the center of the universe, oh, well, that must make perfect sense, okay? She's involved with a boyfriend who is largely violent and inexplicable, and the only way that it's possible to calm him down is to get physical with him. Okay, I don't know. So as a parent, I'd be going, Triss, I want to sit you down. I want to talk about your future. I'm not sure this is a great relationship for you. And that Bureau of Genetic Purity, I'm not sure they've got your best interests at heart. But this is not how teens will take it, because weirdly, teens are swept up in the emotional idea. And we seem to have invested a lot of time in telling teens that being who you are equals just letting free with your emotions. And that's what Triss is, an emotional cannonade, you know, flying across the screen.
But despite all those reservations, you actually think that Allegiant raises good questions, but does it provide good answers to those questions,
that's
Mark?
That's the weird thing. There's a really
Triss's
good question.
Dad, if you will.
Thank you. Triss, listen to me. There's some really good questions that you're working through here. I can understand that. One of them is, what is it that makes us bad? Okay. Now, in the film, it's suggested that what makes us bad initially, this is by the bad guys, is genetics. Okay. That some people are genetically prone to be damaged and therefore they're not going to produce the optimum human behavior. And of course, Triss gets upset about that because everybody is equal, aren't they? And yet at the same time, we've got to ask ourselves, Triss, what about the evidence? What about the fact that society is crashing and burning?
Yeah,
that
Triss.
The fact that we've got this blasted universe out there,
yeah,
and
Triss,
people are pulling guns out every 5 minutes to shoot each other. Why teens are armed in this film, I don't know. By the way, this is a good idea. Don't arm teens. You know, but that said, I mean, honestly, combining handguns with those emotional sort of, you know, feelings, okay. But the key thing here is the question, Why are we mixed up? Why are we struggling? Why did we get to where we are? Why do we have these problems? The problem is we never go anywhere near the idea of sin. The fact that you could be genetically diverse and accept the fact that we're all very different and we don't have to have categories to label people with and yet all have a common problem. And the common problem, whether you're genetically pure, you know, or damaged, is the fact that we have sin. Sin underneath it all. But so long as this film continues to just deal in terms of sort of genetic structures and
behaviors equal virtue.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. We're not really ever going to get at the heart of the problem, which is what the Bible does.
Thank you, Triss's dad. Allegiant opens nationally this Thursday, April 14, stars Shailene Woodley, Theo James, Zoe Kravitz, and a host of other pouty emotional teens. Mark wrote that. It's really quite good. It's rated M for science fiction themes and violence, and it's also rated W as in what? By Mark for a lack of its clear thinking. I see what you did there. If you go to insights.uca.org.au, you might want to do this right now as you're listening to the show. I know you can multitask. Insights.uca.org.au. You can check out a review of Allegiant on that site and see what Insights has got to say. And while you're there, because we're the kind of reviewers that we like to share, and we're happy to have you look and listen to other people's opinions, go for it. They've got reviews of what we've been talking about on the show, Jungle Book, and many other of the blockbusters that are around at the moment. Insights.uca.org.au. Check it out.
But don't get too distracted by your iPad or your computer. We've still got heaps more coming up. In particular, what the Bible has to say about laughter in our April Fool's edition and the top 5 twists of all time. Yes, I'm going to ruin 5 films for you.
Spoiler alert!
Welcome back to The Big Picture with Mark and Ben. It's actually funnier off air, people. Seriously.
Oh, my goodness, do we have some good times in between sessions of The Big Picture. And then we take the ad breaks. I think we should actually record those, Mark, and put them to air.
Or do the court cases after.
We're up to what the Bible's got to say for this week. And this week, as we've already talked about earlier in the show, we decided to include a bit of April foolery in this episode because, well, if you can't bend little things like calendars and well-established traditions and time-space continuum, what's the point of living, Mark?
I see no reason why not, my friend.
Yeah. But it did get us thinking, what's the Bible got to say about our sense of humor? Is the good book good for a laugh? Cue Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark to set us straight.
You may never have heard of the Rhesus Paschalis. That phrase represents a point in the medieval liturgy, just after we speak of the resurrection, where the congregation's actually encouraged to laugh. It simply translates as Easter laughter. When I was in my early teens living in England, my family and I attended an Easter Sunday service at the church of David Watson, who was a well-known Christian leader back in the 1980s. It was one of the most disturbing services I've ever been to. Not because there were spirit slayings or tongues speaking or prophetic words or the like, there was actually none of the above. The disturbing thing about it was the laughter. While everyone in the church was heading up to the rail to take communion, the church band broke into a lively chorus and everyone started laughing and singing and celebrating. Well, my sisters and I burst into tears because we were conservative evangelical types. We weren't used to this kind of thing happening at the most somber point in the church service. What are these nutcases doing, we thought? Well, until recently, I'd thought that this was just a contemporary way of making the point during the church service that the resurrection shouldn't be a somber event at all, be joyful. And on reflection, I really liked that idea. But I've recently discovered that this laughing after communion isn't a contemporary idea at all. In fact, it started back in the Middle Ages with the Rhesus Paschalis. The Rhesus Paschalis was your chance to make fun of the devil, to mock the opponents of God, to say, "Ha, take that, you devils, Jesus rose from the grave, and there's nothing you can do about it." It's not a practice we see enough of in churches these days. I'd love to see it come back. It's a great way of turning on its head the view of Christianity that many people have. Whereas lots of people think of Christians as the fools, stuck in an old-fashioned mindset and out-of-date values, those of us who believe that Jesus in fact rose from the grave think the precise opposite. We laugh at anyone who thinks they can hold back Jesus, who broke the bonds of death and ushered in eternal life for we mortals, and that there might be more to life than we could possibly think. In fact, it's holy laughter. It's the laughter of hope.
Greg Clark, Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator. And thanks very much for Greg always actually being ready to actually come into the show and give us some insight. One of the other things that Greg oversees in his vast empire over at the Bible Society.
He's like an emperor. Why don't we call him Emperor?
Emperor Greg from now on.
Because he's a really humble, nice, down-to-earth bloke. He may not appreciate
us
calling
him. He's a benevolent dictator, is Greg.
Let's go back to Emperor.
Okay, well, Emperor Greg actually oversees, and one of the other things that the Bible Society puts out is Eternity Newspaper. Of course, we actually contribute to that, so we're very happy to be in partnership with them on that.
We are.
And one of the articles that we put out in the last month, in fact, I wrote, was Sweet 2016 and Still Looking for Love. It's my examination.
Aww.
I know.
It's my found me, Mark.
I know that you are.
So what is it actually about?
Well, this article is an examination of the incredible trend in lovemaking TV that's swamping our airwaves at present, including First Dates, The Bachelorette, The 7-Year Itch. We talked about Married at First Sight at the beginning.
All of those
of the show.
Shows we've talked about on this program. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com, check out our reviews.
And go have a look at the Eternity website, because you'll actually see there all of the sort of collation of what those love programs are starting to say about the way that we feel and why broadcasters still haven't found a program that works, because they're looking in the wrong direction. Also, over at this current edition, the April edition of the Eternity Newspaper, you'll find Collective Memory. I love this article. This is an article really worth looking at. It's called Collective Memory. What happens when you begin to forget who you are and even who God is? In the latest April edition, Kaylee Payne explores the Christian experience of dementia, the role the church can play in holding someone's memory for them, and the importance of community and Christian practice for those with memory loss. Look, the April edition of Eternity is definitely one that should be on your coffee table somewhere. Have a look at that. We've come to the top five, and this is what one would say the peak of the big picture each time. We love to get to this point.
Man,
in the show.
I'm so curious to see how you're going to do that, given, as we said a little bit earlier in the show, this is the top five. It's pretty much just a spoiler. We've got to do spoiler alert at the front. It's basically a list full of spoilers.
Let's do a couple of things here to actually set people at ease.
Okay.
The first thing we're going to say is I'm not going to spoil graphically, okay, and I'm going to actually lay out.
We're going to go into lingering detail. We're not going to act out those scenes.
Not going to act out those scenes. That would be pointless because this is radio. Secondly,
but we'd have a good time.
We'd have a great time doing it, but we're not going to do it. The second thing is I've picked films that are at least 10 years old. So let's face it, people, you've had 10 years on DVD and
so
Blu-ray.
So it's on you.
It is on you. If you haven't worked out these spoilers, I think they're fantastic. The best thing about April Fools, let's face it, is the moment you realize you've been had. Okay? And so that's basically what we're going to do. This week in our top five, we're going to break all the rules and talk about the ends of films to a bunch of film buffs such as yourselves, you know, the sort of thing you probably usually run screaming from the room. In fact, actually, the lengths that people will go to avoid spoilers is phenomenal. I actually was sitting in I was waiting for a film to release. There's the one, the Harry Potter in which Sirius Black dies, which I believe is The Order of the Phoenix.
Spoiler!
Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah, there you go. But it just happens. It just happens. Anyway, this film hadn't even come out. It was 6 months coming, and I had a mate who was sitting next to me who'd heard the rumor that someone was going to die, and he literally, every time this preview went on, now he's a reviewer, would stick his fingers in his ears, stand up, and go la, 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 and run out of the cinema.
It's the most annoying thing that other reviewers do at reviews, when they do that, the la, la, la thing with the ears.
Especially when it's one of those private screenings, there are only about five people. Come on.
Okay, right. Look.
This week, we want to let you in on the best jaw-dropping moments you could hope to see with my top five twists in the last 10 years or so.
Five.
This one's older than the last 10 years.
Older than the last 10 years, except for this one. Okay. Now, this one is going to be a bit hard to see because, look, one of the best twists of all time was The Empire Strikes Back, Luke, I am your father. You know, Darth
Everybody
Vader
knows
movie.
It.
Everybody knows. It's part of popular culture now, okay? So I thought I'd do a bit of a Star Warsy thing and use one of those unexpected character abilities. You know, in The Clone Wars 2008, there was that unexpected jaw-dropping moment when Yoda busts out with a lightsaber and everybody's like, hey, I thought he was just this little green dwarf. No, actually he can fight, and so that's fantastic. No wonder he's a Jedi Master all this time, we were wondering. I was sitting next to the same guy who ran out screaming over the whole Harry Potter thing, and he had actually spent this whole sort of like mind blank for the last 6 months.
Like a Jedi mind trick.
Yeah, avoiding everything to do with the Clone Wars. And as a last moment thing, I just leaned over for a joke and said, can't believe that Yoda gets to fight with a lightsaber in this one. I made that up. I had no idea that was going to happen. He looked at me and I went, no, I made it up. That was just a joke. An hour into the film, whack, I just get punched out of the blue on account of the fact that Yoda decides to get a lightsaber. So it's one of those unexpected character abilities. There's a drop jaw. If you didn't notice that Yoda can fight with a lightsaber, I've spoiled it for you.
But it makes your list mainly because you saw it coming.
I was amazed at how prescient I was.
Four.
Let's get on to real jaw-dropping moments. Okay, at number four, I'd like to collect that whole group of spoilers together that I call Surprise, You're Dead. Okay, and the basic is like The Others, you know, in 2001. Suddenly you realize the whole cast is dead.
That was a great movie. I love
Donnie
that film.
Darko, who realizes he's dead, okay, in 2001.
Or is he?
But there's no film that does it better than 1999's The Sixth Sense. Bruce Willis, playing Dr. Malcolm Crowe, realizes he's the one who's deceased, and the boy, Haley Joel Osment, who plays Cole, is the one who can see dead people, who he happens to be. What? Now, the really funny thing about this jaw-dropping moment is the story a mate told me. Everybody was lining up to see The Sixth Sense. It got this sort of thrill, but no one knew why. And everybody was lining up to see it. There were back-to-back screenings, and a mate of mine was actually waiting to go in as another guy walked out of the same cinema saying, I can't believe he was dead the whole time. How do you pay $18 for that? Let's move on. Number three, okay. I like to call this the identity shift twist, okay, when we suddenly realize that someone is not who they say they are, okay. There are great ones in this sort of category, the twist at the end. Psycho, 1960. Come on, if you haven't noticed this yet, Norman Bates, played by Anthony Perkins, turns out to be his mother, okay, who's also...
Who knew? Everybody since that film came out.
Everybody.
So it was a well-guarded secret before it hit screens.
Or The Crying Game, okay? That rather uncomfortable moment when the main character, Fergus, who has fallen in love with a particular woman and spent some intimate time with her, realizes that she's a man. Okay, I don't even know how that works as a plot, but there you go.
No, The Crying Game. Wow, that's unforgettable, that movie.
But the absolute identity shift twist of all time has to be 1999, The Fight Club, okay?
I thought that might be where you're going.
Fantastic, when Edward Norton actually realizes
he is Brad
Pitt.
But the first rule of Fight Club, Mark, is you don't talk about Fight Club, is it not?
Yeah, if you're going to lean across and hit me now, because that's the second rule of Fight Club. Look, when Edward Norton realizes that he's actually gone mad, you know, and he is Brad Pitt, who he's been talking to the entire film.
Haven't you had that experience, Mark, brilliant. Just walking down the street one day realizing, I'm a little bit mad and I'm Brad Pitt?
I'm starting to wonder whether or not you're an extension of my own personality, mate. But that, for the identity shift twist, you can't go past Fight Club. That's just fantastic.
Two.
Unless, of course, you want to move on to the plot twist that doesn't destroy the film. Okay.
Oh, I like the sound of this one.
Yeah, I know. This is the sort of film that I really kind of like, okay? It's the one where in which you can watch the film over and over again, even though you know the plot twist, okay? It's very rare. Often what happens with plot twists is you watch the film once and you go, oh, I can't believe it. And then you watch it a second time to see how they built it in.
Oh, I can believe it.
Now I can believe it. Okay, there you go. But there's every now and again a film's up that actually has a major plot twist and you think, oh, I could actually watch that again and again and again. Nothing like 1968's The Planet of the Apes.
Okay? Oh, great choice.
So the big twist at the end is when Charlton Heston sort of is right at the end of the film, he sees this huge statue of Liberty buried in the sand and he realizes, hang on, I'm not on a foreign world populated by apes. I'm actually on my own world. Wow, who would have thought they had a statue exactly like that on another planet? And that's what I thought. You see, when I watched...
Hang on. So the actual twist is that he's still on Earth.
Yeah, he suddenly realizes, oh my goodness.
But when you were watching the film...
Damn it.
You didn't believe Charlton Heston.
Yeah, that was the thing. He's going, damn it, you blew it all to hell. You guys, you blew it. And me, I'm sitting there going, wow, they've got another planet. What were the odds of another planet that also had the Statue of Liberty that they blew up? And I thought Charlton Heston was going, how could you do that? You've destroyed your own Statue of Liberty.
We've still got ours. You can borrow ours.
Yes, you should. Don't you realize that's the symbol of liberty and you've blown it up, you fools? And I'm thinking, wow, that's a really... And then somebody had to explain to me what had happened. Okay.
What is better than you not understanding Charlton Heston yelling at the Statue of Liberty on his own planet?
It has to be the twist in the tale. And this is the film that everybody lives for. The one where at the last moment, everything gets turned on its head. Like Primal Fear in 1996, you know, when Richard Gere and Edward Norton, you know, suddenly realize that the crazy person they think is crazy is not crazy after all. I love that film so much. I'm not going to spoil it. You should watch.
Edward Norton loves the mad movies. I know. Mad movie twists.
He does mad well. Look, Primal Fear, 1996. Got to go see that. That twist in the tale. Or what about The Village from 2004? You know, it's one of those moments where you get the twist at the end where in which everybody is going, no, what? No, no, really? No, you, all you seem to do is stare at each other and go, no, no, no. You know, that's another great example of that twist in the tale. But there is no film more epic for the twist in the tale than The Usual Suspects in 1995.
Great choice.
All-star cast in the room, and one of them is the villainous Kaiser Soze. I won't give away who it is. It's too good. You know, I don't want to destroy that. You really should go see The Usual Suspects. But here's my clue. Watch Kevin Spacey's walk. Okay, just watch the way he walks. That makes the film. In the last 5 minutes, it makes the film. One of the best lines in cinema, though, it is also in The Usual Suspects, about a real-world spiritual twist, how the devil has managed to get away with it all, with so much of evil in the world, simply by convincing us that we're too smart to believe in him. I can't do better than maybe to play this clip.
They tell me you got the cripple in there from New York.
Yeah.
He mentioned Kaiser Soze.
Who?
After that, my guess is you'll never hear from him again. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. And like that, he's gone.
That is a fantastic line. And it was worth that long orchestral build-up to get to it.
That was actually the Kevin Spacey walk. So you need to see the film, if only to see the Kevin Spacey walk. Look, I feel that's one of those brilliant moments where actually we get to do it live and also remind people that there's a twist, there's a real-life twist going on. You know, the devil has actually twisted the end of this particular tale to make everybody who's influencing think that he's just not there.
And here's the shock twist at the end of this episode of The Big Picture. It's the end.
Oh.
We're about to go. But we'll be back next week.
I've got to do it. I've got it. Guys, you've been pranked. It's not April 1 at all. Oh,
in case you were keeping up with that, not up to this point. What's coming up next week, Mark?
Are fairy tale figures the new superheroes? The huntsman turns Snow White's tale into a blockbuster battle.
Aussie kids singing songs in the outback, the movie.
And from legendary author Stephen King, a new TV experience that tries to save the future by stopping a president's assassination in the past.
Hardy ha, I'm Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley. See you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.